this is the recorded interview with General George C. Marshall. It's a copy of the original. I made it at Pinehurst, North Carolina, on January 15th, 1957. It answered a question of F.C. Pogue. The machine was run by Sergeant William Heppner.
I'm starting now to answer the questions concerning the period of September forward in 1941, questions 78 and 79. Question 78 reads, how serious was this proposal to cut the army? Parenthesis. This was after the extension of the Selective Service, end of parenthesis, question mark. The proposal was very serious at the time. The opposition to a large army was very widespread, and there was the feeling that such an army was passé, no longer needed, and therefore the other proposals for the Navy and the Air demanded first attention. I might say now that we found it very interesting to see how long it took to develop various phases of the Army in the Air, and to the extent that I understood, the Navy. It seemed to me, though I have not the exact records here to consult, that the lengthiest preparation was required for what is ordinarily supposed to be the simplest military setup, that is, a regiment of infantry. When one stops to analyze the conditions, it is not so extraordinary as it might seem. If it's in the air, the plane itself is a complicated machine, which requires very prolonged triple manufacture. The running of that plane requires very precise training. But even so, the instruments are right there. The push buttons and the other means of control are fixed, close at hand. The same thing might be said about a great deal of the Navy training. The men operate in certain places in battle. They are well known. They report to that place. The things they do are predetermined, and the condition in which they do them is in almost violent contrast to the conditions in the ground army. When you were preparing an infantry regiment, which has seldom ever been properly prepared, you have to go understand that in the first place, a great many mechanisms are involved nowadays. That are rather elaborate. Next, that their use comes when the men that handle them are at their worst as to a state of fatigue and discomfort from long marches, from mud, rain, dust, heat, and then they have to operate as a rule at the time of real action in a place they have never seen before, that they have probably occupied in the dark. They have to be in close cooperation with the artillery, may never have seen it then and never have even seen it later because it comes in far behind them. So they have to be hooked up with something that personally they've never had contact with, never seen. That applies to a good many of their weapons. All of these things have to be coordinated. And when the fighting starts on the infantry side, these various things have to be hitched up from the conditions of troops who have had prolonged marches and are very tired and are in an area they have never seen before and under conditions that are very difficult. Whereas in the Navy, a man can take a bath and put on clean underwear and go to his fixed battle station. In the infantry regiment, for example, he has no fixed place that he can go to. It's all in a state of transition and change, and he's probably extremely tired and probably hungry. And also, he's under heavy fire, you know, in most cases. And he is also probably surrounded by very frightening casualties, which are right there for him to see. All of this disturbs the ordinary equilibrium of a man and requires a very high state of discipline and a higher state of technique in training. Therefore, it's a long and far cry from the days when the man took the rifle down from the hooks above the fireplace and went to war. There he had used it many times. He was accustomed to independent action. He was accustomed to the woods. He was accustomed to danger. He was a good shot for the game he had to have in order to live, and for action against the Indians who were always threatening him. All that had changed, and now the average soldier had little or no rifle training. He was off the city streets, and yet he had to do his stuff, as it were, under very difficult and strange conditions. Therefore, this all means that the natural assumption was that it is a very simple matter to train the ground forces, the infantry and the others, and a very complicated matter to train the other forces, the air and the naval forces and all. Well, that was not the case at all. They had something fixed to tie to. It was, for instance, in our artillery. They required a high degree of training, but that was made easier, as it were, because of the fact that the men were tied to the gun, and the gun prevented dispersal of their efforts and gave them something to hitch to during the action. All of this affected the public conceptions of what was needed. They knew airplanes were complicated. They knew that they were new. They had a very enlarged idea as to what they could do, particularly because of the German effective use of airplanes at the outbreak of the war, where they demoralized all the forces of France, both military and civilian. This affected public opinion very decidedly. This made it very hard to get a plain, logical reaction. Everybody was fighting for something. Each service wanted to get an increase. Each service wanted more money. And we had the regrettable state of one service working against another. The British, for example, were very intense in their efforts in order to get more metal, to get more tanks from us, to get more weapons from us, and they opposed a lot of our proposals, particularly my proposals, and So we have the peculiar situation of the British and the Navy, as it were, to a certain extent the air, working together to prevent the ground forces from being organized. I was very conscious of this, and it required a good deal of self-restraint not to become unduly irritated by the business. All of it had a background, of course, a public misunderstanding. The airplane is very photogenic. The Navy is very photogenic. The airplane was a new weapon, been very heavily advertised by the initial fighting in Europe. And as a result, it was not at all dramatic to ask for the forces we needed with the ground army, which were going to be compellingly required once the real fighting started. It was rather interesting when we landed in Normandy to find that Germans got caught with most of their mechanized divisions up near the front. That was a very serious tragedy for them. They wanted plain infantry divisions. And they had too much mechanized where they couldn't use them at all to their advantage. We didn't want mechanized divisions in, but to a very minor extent at the start. We had to have infantry divisions. And the call from our commanders were for infantry divisions. All of this was very slow in developing an understanding throughout the army. But as it became evident, if you wanted to get an air base, you use these ground troops. If you want to hold an air base, you use these ground troops. And without them, you were, in a sense, impotent. So the fight at this time, that's referred to in this question, was conducted without any real understanding of the question by the columnists and by the various writers, and certainly not by the public. And they all played to the dramatics, you might say, of the thing, which was the budding air force. Of course we had to have an air force, but if we didn't have an army and a ground army, we didn't have anything. Therefore the fight was to maintain the ground army, and all of the advice and pressure that we were getting was against the ground army, beginning with the British, who wanted the material that was going into the ground army and going through our Navy and through our Air Corps. I would find that a view of mine expressed in regard to these things was directly opposed by these forces. And I would finally find out in many cases just where the opposition was coming from, who was making it. I notified the British people, their representatives, confidentially once or twice, that they didn't stop this business, I would have to come out and pillory them publicly. But that was about the last thing I wanted to do, because it would do so much to the advantage of the Germans and so much to the harm of the international allied accord. So this was a very serious affair, and it remained serious until the real fighting began and people's understanding of the situation grew to a proper appreciation of what was needed in a balanced force. We use too many general terms like that in discussing these matters. A balanced force, that didn't mean anything to the average man. It meant little to a congressman, and it was not at all convincing. You had to find some other way in order to explain it. I found these difficulties in dealing with the president. All his advice was coming in for the Navy, who needed the steel and material of that nature, and these men too, and he was personally, of course, intimately familiar with the Navy, and naturally very responsive to its requests, or I might better say, demands. The air people had a plentiful backing from outside. We had certain columnists who could tell you exactly what to do and how to do it. With regard to the air, there are a good many phases of the matter that they didn't touch on, as a matter of fact, that they didn't understand at all. So I regarded this period as very serious and is very difficult to handle. I'm sorry that I haven't a distinct recollection of my conversations, in particular with the President. I had a number on these questions, and this particular occasion, evidently I had a very serious one. I can imagine just about what it was, but I might say here that early in my associations with the President, I didn't understand that I must find a way to do the talking, because he did all the talking, and I just have to sit and listen to the President of the United States. Later on, I found out a little bit better how to handle this, so that I could get my points across, but at that time I was not sufficiently adept at dealing with a man who was as clever as Mr. Roosevelt was about holding the boards and putting over his ideas. In this situation, he had all the pressures from the outside, and against what I was putting forward, practically none at all of my issues that I was bringing up, and required a great deal of wear and tear before I could make an understanding of this clear to his satisfaction. As I repeat again, I don't recall exactly what took place on this particular conversation, but I know that I was in a prolonged fight, as it were, in order to bring about a proper understanding of what the question really was. And the opposition was in these forces of our own and the British, who wanted the metal, who wanted the tanks, who wanted the materiel. It was a very trying and maddening situation, and it was very difficult for one to keep the temper and to find what was the proper approach to make in the varying circumstances of the case, particularly against a columnist who held the public attention. I always was a commentator also, I might say. Now I'll turn to question 79. Can you recall high points of your discussion with Mr. Roosevelt on this? Well, I see I've answered practically everything in connection with that. Now I turn to the late 1940, where it states it is apparent that no reliable planning for possible war with Germany, Italy, or Japan could be carried out without a fairly definite understanding of what could be expected from Britain in such an event. And then it goes on to explain about the conference that was established. The first question asked me is to discuss some of the background of these conversations. Admiral Stark and I had long conversations on the subject, and he conducted the conference. I didn't attend much of it. We were both rather disturbed that this might leak out, and that would be worked against us, particularly by those who were opposed to any preparations of any kind, particularly from the Middle West. I felt with Admiral Stark that if we didn't have some talks with the British, we would start with no basis at all, and if war developed later on. And at the time this conference was first established, we needed to have some at least vague idea of what we could expect from the British, what sort of help they would want, and what sort of help they would want from us. The latter was more important in the general situation probably than the first thing I mentioned. So from that point of view, it was very important. I don't think these talks had anything to do with fastening on us the vital problem of war. It was merely a question of knowing what we might run into and what the conditions would be under which we met it. And we all these things the British told us largely were secrets, so that we had an understanding of what it was. We were friendly to Great Britain, and how far that friendship would carry us was something else. That was for the person. Well, we needed to know what sort of response they would like and what sort of assistance they could give. Those things we didn't know at all. And these talks gave us some small basis for that. And I don't feel that in any way we committed the United States to take any specific military action unless we were attacked. The advantage of the talks were they were done without regard to the president, and that was managed that way so as not to involve our government in any seemingly fixed understandings. The president of the United States wasn't involved in the talks at all, and as I recall, he wasn't even supposed to know about it. It was just done on our conception, in order to find out what we needed to know without in any way involving him in any commitments of any kind. The next question is, did you feel that the conversations committed the United States to any specific military action unless we were attacked? They didn't commit us to any line of action. It's thoroughly understood that this was outside of the direction of the commander-in-chief. Next question is, did you or any other American commander ever contemplate preventative war action against any of the Axis members? Not that I recall. 84. Did you feel that it is a mistake to engage in these conversations while we were officially neutral? I felt that it was necessary to us to know more about what the conditions were in case we became involved. And the actions of the Germans were so hostile in general, and we were so ill prepared that we needed every advantage we could get in case we were drawn into the war. Question 85. What was my feeling in 41 about the possibility of a German attack on Latin America? My feelings to Latin America at that period of the war was that they had so many underground movements that the Panama Canal was threatened. I felt they could suddenly raise a sort of revolutionary attack. They had German reservists scattered around the country, and we'd already had examples of their having a complete setup to seize a country without hardly any troops being involved. We were very fearful of the Panama Canal being struck from Colombia or one of these other South American countries. We felt that the movement across the South Atlantic from Dakar could be carried out by very few troops. If on the Latin American side they were able to spring one of these arranged revolutionary performances that had been so successful in the Scandinavia countries and elsewhere. For that reason, we were very much concerned. They had the Germans, the country pretty well organized, and presented to us a threat to the Panama Canal, which could not be ignored. That would be a very tragic matter if it got in there, at least close enough to destroy the canal, which by efficient bombing could be done without too much trouble. I didn't think any large troop movement would probably be involved. I think this question has an error in it. I don't understand it, but I will not try to answer it. The question of German collapse rapidly in case of a German attack, I don't quite get that. I'll have to talk to you about that later. Turn it off. Question 87. The meetings on board the Augusta and the Prince of Wales. In the first place, the meeting came as a complete surprise. The Army members, that is the heir, General Arnold, and others, saving myself, had no knowledge of it until we were well up the coast on the cruiser Augusta. Naturally, therefore, there was not much opportunity to plan for a specific meeting. To me, the meeting was largely a get-together for the first time. An opportunity to meet the British Chiefs of Staff and to come to some understanding with them how they worked and what their principal problems were. We were in no position at that time to lay very heavy matters before them. I think the best answer to those who feel that we were planning a war detail ahead of time would be the fact that we had so little basis for plans at the time of the meeting on the Augusta. So only the things that were just almost self-evident could be discussed by us. The British would like to have gone much further. They were at this business every day, all day, on a very definite war-making basis. We were in the position of mobilizing and equipping an army. And just how all this was to be handled on our side largely remained to be determined. Therefore, we were not prepared to give them any fixed advice or agreements, I should say, as to what was to be done. They wanted such things as early as they could get them, of course. But we had to go through a great deal of getting together on our own part with a solid understanding of just what the plans were that we were struggling to carry out. We had very weighty matters on our hands. The battle for the maintenance of the army, which we only won by a single vote, was being fought out at this time. People don't even recall that today. It seems to be a very negligible matter. It meant the complete destruction of the fabric of the army that we had built up. And we would be in a worse predicament than we were a year before. It would have set us back about a year and a half to 2 years. And of course, that would be the greatest of tragedies. Rather than the actual war-making plans, we were in a struggle for survival against the misunderstandings of our public and the failure of our Congress to resist the criticism, and the magazines who played up the men to desert in, according to the Ohio cry, that life utilized quite freely. We were in a very desperate situation to maintain the little we had and not have it entirely destroyed, because we had largely dismembered the regular army in order to permit the buildup of the new army, because some of the increases were almost 1,000%, and we had to take our few existing regular organizations completely apart and partial amount, some at the rate of about 20 men per new organization. Now, this was all threatened and was only saved by one vote. So these matters were weighing on our wisdom, and we were in a very desperate plight. The British would like to go ahead with fixed plans. We were in no condition whatsoever to go ahead at that time with fixed plans. I think that the tragic situation that we were involved in should be much better understood when it's realized how complete would have been the destruction of our army. The more we've been in a worse predicament than we were the year before, because we had destroyed the organization of the regular forces in order to give a nucleus for the new forces. Now all of that was to be wiped out, and we were completely back, not back to a thing, but far removed from that. We were just literally destroyed for the time being. And the people don't understand that at all today. In fact, they've forgotten entirely how close a squeak it was that we saved ourselves, or we were saved by a single vote. It's hard to realize that such a thing could happen, but it so very nearly happened that all of our minds, concentrations were centered on that, trying to find some way to avoid the issue. It was rather striking, the fact that we were able to go up to our Argentia without it becoming public. Later on, we got to the first meeting at Casablanca that way. But the minute we began to enlarge on these meetings, began to take the suites of people there, then the secrecy evaporated. And we found ourselves proclaimed by the Germans to the world as just where we were going, notably Cairo. And the secrecy part of it dissolved. But here it was secret. And I know when General Arnold, who was representing here, I told him what was happening, what we were going to do after we were at sea. Up to that time, all he knew was that he was to take heavy clothes. Question 88. Comments on the views expressed by the staff of a rather pessimistic nature as to the British in particular, and as to our own role at that time. It was very difficult for us to understand the British. They had been through a terrible series of events. They were, in a sense, very poorly prepared, except as to their naval strength. And I think the word poorly hardly describes it. I could not say utterly unprepared, because they had made certain preparations. The Germans had made every preparation. And they had made it, which is generally overlooked or forgotten. For war at a specific time, they were appropriating fabulous amounts of money, as it seemed to us then. But it was for a war at a specific time, not in an indefinite future, which is what we were up against, not knowing whether we would actually go to war with Germany, and certainly hoping that we would not. The observations of the various staff officers are rather typical of the time. But I was more interested in Wedemeyer's expression of the as to the defeatist attitude of the British papers. There is no getting away from the fact that they were pessimistic. Equally, there's no getting away from the fact that Mr. Churchill was the buoyant force in maintaining the empire, together with the characteristic attitude of the British. To hold out under very difficult circumstances. My own thoughts at the time were the extreme difficulty I found in getting what seemed to me was a proper appreciation of the situation. There are many things in the British procedure of which our people were very critical. On the other hand, issues had arisen which proved to me we had a failure in many cases to understand the situation. For example, it'll be remembered that Congress has passed a law which restrained the President from making any allotments of materiel and so forth to Great Britain of a military nature without the approval of the Chief of Staff. The same applied to naval materiel. An Admiral Stark. I think the law was entirely unconstitutional, but there was not time then to work this out. Thereupon fell upon us to do the best we could under the circumstances, which often were quite embarrassing. But things arose under these conditions which were somewhat illuminating. For example, as I recall, we turned over 15, I think it was, Flying Fortresses to the British, for experimental purposes. I was a little ashamed of this, because I felt that I was straining at the subject in order to get around the resolution of Congress. Actually, when we got into it and did it, it soon became apparent that the important thing was exactly that, to let them have the planes for experimental purposes. And we should have done it much earlier, because we found difficulties with the planes that the Air Corps had not perceived at all, and they could hardly be used. Remember, there was the complete absence of tail gunners and some other things, quite evident later on, but not at that moment. There were other things of a somewhat similar nature. While they were related to this factor, which involved me in the difficult business of deciding whether a certain thing should be done for the British or not, deciding with or against the President. And Mr. Stimson would become very much worried. He was intensely desirous of assisting the British, and he would speak to me as a man of high honor, trying to find some way for me to do these things when I couldn't find it. And I felt it was important to be very strict in the matter, because I thought the law was unconstitutional. I thought the important thing is to get it revoked. And the important thing, therefore, was to be very exacting in carrying it out and not try to evade it and defeat its purpose. And in due time, they did revoke it. But it was a very difficult situation. And it was under that, under the conditions of that law, that I had to approve the transfer to the British of large amounts of arms at the time of Dunkirk. I've forgotten the numbers now, but that could easily be checked. But as I recall, there was something like 1 million rifles and 600,000 machine guns, and a large number of automatic rifles, and from 500 or 600 75 millimeter guns. I know the great problem with the rifles was that we only had about 10 rounds of ammunition for each gun, and we couldn't cut down our ammunition in reserve that we had beyond that point. Which is a very peculiar situation when the Chief of Staff of the Army could turn down the President and the Secretary of War. To my mind, wholly unconstitutional. Nevertheless, it had to be carried out until it was proven unconstitutional. And I felt incumbent upon me to be extremely exacting in observing, because I thought in that way we would get the earlier repeal of the law, which we did. Now, in these various situations, I began to learn things about the British and their attitude, their confusion about us, and are confused about ourselves and about them. The matter of the flying fortresses was very illuminating to me, that we could be so far off center on the matter and not realize it at all. We got into a somewhat similar thing on the question of tanks. Our tanks were easily the most mobile, the most easily controlled, perfectly controlled of all the tanks. But they were deficient, very decidedly, in their fighting qualities, in the arrangement of the tanks so that they could be fought with efficiency, as that came out. So we would have the British disapproving our model and ourselves being very contentious of theirs, when the issue was the British had it right on the fighting part and we had it right on the mobility of the tank. And not till I got a prominent informed Britisher in my office and told him, "Now just confidentially between you and me, tell me what is wrong about this tank affair," and he told me what they saw. And I looked into it and found out about our side of it, and they were both wrong. And then it was comparatively easy to get the matter adjusted, but doing it all behind the scenes. Well, that was the case in so many things. We just didn't understand them, and they certainly didn't understand us. And they had information as to the battle efficiency of things that we just refused to accept and yet we were without experience in this matter. We did have experience in the mobility of tanks, because we could do that without a battle. But we didn't have any experience in the fighting of the tank, and we had that quite wrong. So I had to follow a scheme of very confidentially getting certain Britishers to give me their side behind the scenes, and then to go on the other side and get our side confidentially, and then try to act in a very even way towards both sides. All these things affected the opinions of the various officers concerned, and many things that came up in Great Britain and their misfortunes, which were many at that time, caused very decided feelings to develop among some of our best informed officers. Which was only natural. The main point was to control them in such a way that we eventually came out with the sound decision. Question 89. I think these reactions are somewhat of an answer to those who argue that the Army and Navy were plotting the war throughout 1941. The trouble in all of that is that there were those who felt politically that we must do nothing, we must be utterly defenseless, or we were plotting war. Well, that would have been suicidal. And the fact that we made ourselves capable of exerting military influence made the Germans very much more cautious in their procedure. I never had any idea that we could settle the question in Europe by purely air offensive. And my views are the same today as they were then. And I think they will continue to be that. That you've got to get down and hold things. You can't treat them purely by air. A very good example of this, I think, is the war in Korea. We had complete air superiority. We had all the air, they had none. And yet we couldn't do anything until we got the troops to get down on the ground and move in and take these places. It's the greatest mistake the air people make, is talking about doing things by air alone. It just isn't done that way. You destroy plants. You can destroy cities. There's a great deal of work of that kind that can be done. But that doesn't win. That aids you if you do something else. Or something else has got to go with the air offensive. Turn that on. Question 92. Was this neglect of Philippines defenses in 1930, due largely to economy drives? I was not in the War Department at that time, and I imagine that was the case. Beyond that, I can't answer this question. 93. Did you feel that we might have been wise to have withdrawn from the Philippines in 1940? It's very hard to answer this question. There were certain things starting to increase the defensive power of the Philippines, but they had not yet gotten well underway, and they would proceed very slowly. the quantity production of materiel had not yet developed. That refers to airplanes, ammunition, anti-aircraft materiel, all things of that general nature, which were so necessary in the Philippines, until they began to be received in adequate supply. There was little that could be done. Now the question was whether we would find time to build up the defenses in the Philippines. There was General MacArthur's plan for raising the Philippine army. That had been started, but it takes a long time to develop an army. It takes a greater time to develop the discipline and the training of such an army. Again, it proved the time was lacking. The only successful development that we achieved was by doubling the size of the Philippine Scouts. The Philippine Scout Organization was a very fine, disciplined organization, and it was comparatively a simple matter to double its size because it could absorb that many new men and maintain its disciplinary standards and very shortly its training standards. The whole question then was how long would they have in which to develop these things? The new organized force, the materiel, the requirements. It takes a long time to get materiel on the development line, the quantity production basis. And that was absolutely essential to the Philippines. As a matter of fact, the quantity production in most of these things didn't really come until the last 2 months. And then, as I recall, and then we shipped just as much as we could get out there. I remember they were unloading boats all night in Manila, trying to get it out to the troops. And of course, that didn't admit of getting this army trained. There was not time for that. You can't quantity production an army until you get one thoroughly disciplined, thoroughly trained and organized. If that had been developed, had there been time for that, then there would have been a very stable base, and the Japs would have had a hard problem to solve, a hard nut to crack. The development of the supply thing was really tragic as regards Hawaii and as regards the Philippines, because these things came into quantity production at the very last minute. And when we started to get the material to them, some small amount we actually did get out. But a great deal was on shipboard in the process of being sent out. I remember the tragic result of a lot of fighter planes. This one group of fighter planes had gone through its training program complete, and I sent it down to the Louisiana maneuvers to give it 2 weeks, as I recall, of maneuvers with the ground troops, which would be its main purpose in the Philippines, before starting it off for Manila. Now they had to pack up part of the planes in order to ship them, and they were on the Atlantic, on the Pacific, when the war broke out, and they landed in Australia, requiring a certain setup of preparation. There is one very small instrument which enables the pilot to fire the wing guns. I forget what you call it, and I certainly knew it then because it had such fateful consequences for us. In opening the crates hurriedly, just starting up any base operation there in Australia, they threw away these vital little soloids, I think you call it, because they were nailed to the side of the crate. Therefore, we had no way of firing the guns. Now, to get the guns from the Philippines, we have to fly them up halfway to the small islands east of Sumatra. I've forgotten their names now. Up near, Fiji Islands. No, they were up in the Pacific. They were Dutch islands in the main. We could renew their gas there, and they could get to Mindanao, and we had the pilots to fly them. Well, we had no sonars. And we tried to get them out to Australia. We sent them on plane after plane to try to get them out there. All the time, these things had been thrown away when they were uncrating the planes in Australia, very hurriedly by very crude work direction. So when these planes finally were equipped with the solenoids and all ready to go, you no longer could land in the Dutch Islands, and therefore they could not be shipped to the Philippines, which was a tremendous loss to General MacArthur. All of these things were working against us. The same thing happened in Honolulu. We had to hold planes there for a long time, because that was a long flight for planes in those days, waiting on the delivery of more, and waiting on favorable winds, because they were unfavorable, and the flight could not be made to Honolulu if the wind was at least unfavorable. All of this came into importance as we got along now, but the tragedy of it all was to me that just as we got quantity production, our delivery possibilities were cut off. The ammunition was very serious, particularly for the Dutch, and we wanted to give them some ammunition, but we hadn't gotten any yet from our supply. But it came in about 2 or 3 weeks, but not in time. Now, the neglect of the Philippine defenses was a matter of the fact that our country had never appropriated the money for the equipment, the material that was needed, because it takes at least almost a year to get most of these things, and a year and a half to 2 years to get the others after the act is once passed. And of course that all worked against us when it came to the question of the Philippines. I recall very well when I was struggling to get larger appropriations from Congress in order to get in orders of some size on material and things, an officer of great distinction, I mean very great distinction, who's highly respected today, coming to me and trying to persuade me not to ask any more money of Congress, because he said it was useless. We couldn't get into France or Western Europe. The Germans had it, and we never could get them out. And the best we could do is make ourselves safe here in America. Well, that comes from a very high-ranking person in our country, one whose views are highly respected. You can see how hard it was to get these appropriations through. And I ran into almost the same reaction regarding appropriations in Korea. Well, they said, if you haven't got it now, you won't have time to get it. In other words, just don't try, because they probably won't get it in time. However, we did get it in time. In both cases, though, it was too late for the Philippines entirely. Just what the decisions were regarding the Philippines before I became chief of staff, I don't know. And the events happened so rapidly when I did become chief of staff, because we were then plunged into a situation where a war was started by the Germans, and we had to get ready for whatever possibility we ran into, that I didn't have any time to go into past history of these various affairs. The lack of anti-aircraft guns was tragic, and particularly for the naval anchorages and bases in Cavite and other places in the Philippines. But we just didn't have them at all. So my action in many of these cases was purely because we didn't have any of the materiel. And it meant I had to take it away from something. I didn't dare take it away from Europe because if we lost in Europe, we were sunk completely. And we had to win that campaign. Question 93. There were too many ifs and ands and buts involved in this matter to give a definite reply. It is a matter of months that we got in quantum production. It is a matter of months that we got the Philippine Army organized. All these things were factors which have had to do with the increased defense of the islands, and you couldn't tell way back just how that would work out. Question 94. I wouldn't undertake to answer this. 95. Question is a little indefinite. I don't recall my telling Quezon about the lack of preparation because Quezon didn't want to spend more money on the defenses. Matter of fact, if he told me after, that is Quezon, he was very anxious to do things there. I couldn't answer this. Question 96. I do not recall clearly how this matter of MacArthur's command in the Far East was established, but to the best of my recollection, I propose that he be put in command. But question number 97. I do not recall enough about this to give an answer. Question 98. I have no comment to make because I do not recall the detail that's discussed. Question 99, Panama Canal. We were having constant difficulty over the command question, which I am endeavoring to be settled. I'm one of the Navy to have overall command in the Alaskan district, and I proposed that, thinking if we get that settled, then we could move down to Hawaii and settle that in time, and then go down to the Panama Canal and settle that. But the Navy was very loath to accept my proposal about the Alaskan theater, and I suppose for the reason that they thought that would obligate them to accept my views as to Hawaii. My view as to Hawaii was, though I had not expressed it as I recall at that time, was that the Navy should have the overall command. But when it came down to the Panama, I thought the Army should have the command. I never got around to my expression of that fact.
However, after this trouble with Van Voorhis and some other details that do not come out in your presentation, I notified them that this thing had to be settled right away. And my dim recollection is that they removed the commander they had there then. And we began to get the matter somewhat straightened out. It was a very tragic affair. And I was much concerned that it gained no publicity, because the public would have been widely aroused if they found such a thing as that, with hanging fire over various disagreements between the Army and the Navy.
This is an interview with General George C. Marshall, Pinehurst, January 22nd, 1956.
Working all right, you ready?
Yes, sir. This is answer 48 to page 16, and starts the consideration of the war important. 48. Following the start of the war in Poland, as to whether or not the President proceeded with extreme caution in 1939 on preparedness matters. This is a fact. He proceeded with great caution, and it was very difficult to get action on the important military requirements of that day. I might here digress to say that I had early made up my mind that I, so far as possible, was going to operate as a member of a team, political and otherwise, military, that while it would be difficult at times, and there would be strong pressures for me to appeal to the public, I thought it was far more important in the long run that I be well established as a member of the team and try to do my convincing within that team, rather than to take action publicly, contrary to the desires of the President and certain members of Congress. There were a certain group of senators at this time who were very intent on going ahead much more rapidly than the administration was willing to do, and their pressure on me at all times was very great. But I restrained my actions for the reason that I foresaw that it was going to be very important for me to establish the fact that I would not run off to a public appeal, that rather I would try my level best to deal within the team of which the President was the head. I recall that during this period, particularly at the time of the emergency proclamation, which the Attorney General was taking the lead. He incidentally later became a member of the Supreme Court. He was the man that gained great prominence by his action as governor of Michigan in connection with the sit-down strike. I can't recall his name now. But I got some action from him, which enlarged on the President's precise instructions to him. And Mr. Roosevelt was rather resentful. There were several things that happened here that are rather interesting. One refers to the Chiefs of Staff. It had proved almost impossible to arrange any setting with the Navy that would have leave us with a chief of the Air Corps. The Navy had its own air, and it was resentful of the Army's semi-independent Air Force, and the Army Air Force had a large number of young men in it who were going to Congress outside of their authorized actions and appealing to them, and they were getting great backing because the Air Corps was a very photogenic affair, and the action of the German Air Corps was very spectacular in Europe. So its great action in the invasion of France had not yet occurred. Murphy was the Attorney General that I was, whose name I was trying to get. The Secretary to the President, who was a good friend of mine, called me over to look at the President's message, which Murphy had drafted in connection with this emergency action. Mr. Roosevelt was reluctant to go the whole way in this emergency business, and this was a much restricted line of action. In it, he referred to the fact that these various portions of the armed force were being well led, and mentioned me as Chief of Staff and Admiral King as head of the Navy. I got the secretary, he later died, to alter this and have him include General Arnold as Chief of the Air Corps. Well, of course, General Arnold was under me because the Air Corps was part of the Army. And that would take congressional legislation to change. But when the President came out with this message, in which he referred to his military leadership, of myself as Chief of Staff, of Admiral King as the head of the Navy, and of General Arnold as head of the Air Corps, we had a separate Air Corps to all intents and purposes. And the matter was settled right then. And though it remained, the Air Corps remained under me, Arnold had proceeded as a member of the Chiefs of Staff, which had been opposed by the Navy. The other matter was trying to increase the number of men. There was some current legislation that I've forgotten now, which was coming into effect, which was giving us a certain increase. And I was trying to go beyond that. They were unwilling to do so because Mr. Roosevelt was very intent on holding this emergency action down. And so while I got a slight increase in the affair, I didn't at all get the general increase that I had hoped for. Mr. Roosevelt complained to Murphy about this draft because he said they were making it very embarrassing for him, Mr. Roosevelt. And moving into things, they knew he was partially opposed to. I might say that, trying to read into Mr. Roosevelt's mind, what was going on was his feeling politically that the Middle West was so solidly against him that if he moved suddenly into an enlarged military effort, he would encounter such opposition from the Middle West that he wouldn't be able to manage the affair. This is later borne out by the fact that the Ohio movement over the hill in Ohio took on such volume that it is only by one vote that the complete dissolution of the Army forces was avoided. So politically he was right, and he was keeping a very close touch on all the developments, and the Middle West developments were very reluctant to anything that smacked of a preparation for war. So you will find throughout this period the President moving very carefully, in a very restrained manner, and I would find myself before congressional committees, a few members of which, notably Senator Lodge and Senator Miller Tidings, several others of that stripe, who wanted to go much faster and much further, pressing me to do things which I would not do because I knew I was going flatly against the president's desires. I might say also that there was a factor that permeates all of this, particularly in the size of the officer candidate schools, that is entirely lost sight of, but those who just look at the figures and react from that. In 1917, the officer candidate schools were started up without the authorization of Mr. Wilson. It was done largely on the enthusiastic backing of General Wood's friends in New York at the Plattsburgh camps. Now that was a very brief period of instruction, and that was all the officers got. Well, of course, that was a lot better than nothing. But by the standards we were going for, in this new war, they were wholly unacceptable to us. But those that had figured decidedly in that Plattsburgh movement now tried to take over and dictate exactly how we should do this thing. I remember bringing up to Mr. Simpson once the fact that Australia was moving much more rapidly than we were, getting their officer school started and commissioning young officers. Well, later on we had a very difficult time with this Australian movement because of the poor training of the officers. And we were determined that we should have well-trained officers for a heavy fighting force. Mr. Granville Clark, who worked so hard in all these matters, Ella Ewell Jr., and Mrs. Simpson was closely allied to them, Bill Donovan, and all of those men were pressing for action, with which I was not at all in accord. And when Mr. Simpson came in as Secretary of War, he was with them in his first actions. The first thing he did when I went up to call on him, just before he formally accepted and came down to Washington, was to talk to them over the phone and press me to move ahead in this very much more rapidly than I was, and which I was unwilling to do for other reasons that I will give now. One thing that restrained me throughout this thing was we didn't have the instructors. We were so short of officers that we didn't have the men to train the others. One reason we were slowed up on the volunteer and the draft act was that we had nobody to train these men if we got them in, and we just couldn't risk going into this thing in a slipshod manner. I remember that Martin, the ex-young president of the New York Stock Exchange, was being trained as a private by a corporal who'd been in the Army about 10 years and never got promotion from a private to a corporal until this big change came. And they had to put him in an instructor. Well, he was no good at all at that. Yet he was training Martin, who was a brilliant man, who's now head of the Federal Reserve, and we had nobody else to use. So I wanted to go as fast as we were able to manage the thing. That was all ignored. They just wanted what I call numbers, the number racket, which I wouldn't accept at all. So we had a very hard time, and particularly Mr. Stimson this time, because he was against the way we were going. Everybody in the War Department was a unit in this matter. We were opposed to these large training camps they wanted to have because we had no instructors, and we couldn't tear that. But a little we did have all the pieces in order to produce a half-baked organization. And this is a very difficult thing to do. And we were in Dutch with the Secretary of War right from the start on that. And it got to a very, very difficult point. I did something at one stage, which I think is very reprehensible on the part of a government official, the more so when he's a military official, which is a long-enduring status. Came to a certain point in this matter where it was the pressure
and the advice of the Secretary of War were coming entirely from New York. They were Fritz Patterson had come down. He was a training camp man. This wasn't just bailiwick, he was on the supply side, but he moved into this. Bill Donovan was into this. A member of the New York Times publishing house. The Reserve General was in it. And they finally got to the point where they were going to put this over. And I then told Mr. Stimson, I said, "Very well, Mr. Stimson, I've done my best. And I have the entire staff with me. They all see this thing alive. To avoid this dilemma, now it's arisen and it's going to take form, apparently. And I tell you now that I resign the day you do it." I think that's a, as I say, a rather reprehensible attitude for a member of the government at a time like this, particularly when he's a military member, when he's a career man, but nothing else could stop the thing. So I decided I would just take that stand. They're going to do it, and I considered it a colossal mistake that they would do it without me. But behind this all was the President's unwillingness to go rapidly at this particular time. British to the present, picture him as trying after 37 to meet the country, get the country into war with Germany. Evidence like the above, it refers to the unwillingness to rapidly expand the army, which seemed to indicate that this there's no basis for this. Well, that is true. Of course, you must say that Mr. Roosevelt, his reluctance was because the country wasn't ready for it. Because the Middle West wasn't ready and would oppose it violently. On my side, the technical military side, was the fact that we didn't have the people, we didn't have the instructors and all to handle these people and to train them properly. See, the regular army was very, very small when the war broke out in Europe, exceedingly small. And it's going to be very hard to find the people to do the training. And the reserve training at that time was not sufficiently crystallized to use them at the start. It was quite a while before they were available to give satisfactory service in a training capacity. I don't know that the President's action in any way involved a consideration that he was waiting for the fall of France. It shocked the world with this belief. No one at that time thought France was going to fall. And it came as a great shock when the invasion of France occurred and the tanks went through onto the French side and took went into hiding in the forest and then came out and executed their real slaughters. After that, that all came as a great surprise. I know it did to the President, because I talked to him about it. He was consulting me as to what to expect from this sort of action, which came as a great surprise to him, as well as it did to the world. There's another section here which is headed with a statement. The Army in 1939-40 was sometimes criticized for not asking for all it needed. General Marshall was aware of the needs, but he avoided going over the heads of his superiors. So-called military experts say that I and my staff failed to show sufficient imagination concerning the needs. I don't think that is quite right. People have forgotten today what a difficult time we had raising an army. How bitter was the opposition to raising it. How strong was the influence in the Middle West. And we began to get the army in some size in 1941. It almost dissolved, was only saved by one single vote.
I find many intelligent men today that don't recall that at all. Yet that was a historic, almost a fatal point in our military history of the war. We have to move very cautiously. If I had ignored public opinion, if I had ignored the reaction to Congress, we would literally have gotten nowhere, because everybody in positions of authority knew what we needed. They were unwilling to go ahead. They were unwilling to give it support. And I have to be very careful, I felt, and I still think, I have to be very careful not to create the feeling that I, as the leader of the military portion of the affairs at that time, was trying to force the country into a lot of action, which it supposed. I was trying to get the Congress to do it. I was trying to get the public to do it. I was trying to have these ardent supporters of this action take the field, not against me. I understood what we need far better than they did. But if the public turned on me because I was pressing all these things, it would be very destructive. I know, apparently it will come up later in these discussions, that I was much criticized because I didn't take the lead in the Selective Service legislation. Well, I very partly didn't take the lead. I wanted to come from others. It did come from Wadsworth, and I've forgotten who the other senator was who had been defeated and was going to retire in a few months. Then I could take the floor and do all the urging that was required in the case. But if I led off with this urging, I would have defeated myself before I started. And I was very conscious of that feeling. So I could get the civilians great prominence, take the lead in urging these things, and I could take up the cudgels and work it out. And that was very much the case, for example, of Selective Service. No one had to tell me how much it was needed. I knew that years before. But the great question was, how do you get it? Nobody had been able to get it, except Mr. Wilson, the outbreak of the other war. Now it is being very violently opposed, again, by the Middle West. And the problem was, how did we get this across? That was my reaction to it, that I get it started by someone of prominence in civil life. Then we could take it up and push it from that time out. It wasn't for me to establish a reputation because I asked for Selective Service. No one had to tell me it was needed. I knew it full well, many times better than the man in the street. You could say that the Army played politics during this period. That is a crude expression. Actually, we had regard for politics. We had regard for the fact that the President didn't feel assured that he could get the backing of the people generally, in the Middle West in particular, at that time, and we had to move with great caution. I recall that when I was working on some of these things, that in one case I talked to I don't know how many Republican congressmen, enough to fill the room, the private dining room of the Army Navy Club, and I talked to them in this issue where we only got one vote to save us. I talked to them from 7 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning, struggling with them to suit. There, I remember one man said, well, that's all very well. You put the case very well, but I'll be damned if I'm going to go along with Roosevelt. And my reply to that was, you're going to let plain hatred of the personality dictate to you to do something that you think you realize is very harmful to the interests of the country. Of course, I didn't say this publicly to anybody. I don't know if I've ever given public expression to this meeting. But I had all the Republican congressmen in there, and out of that I only got a few votes. Well, as a matter of fact, they all would have, that did vote for it, would have lost their place in Congress, except for the fact that the war came.
then everybody turned to, and there was no question of that. But I told them, I said, I realize that if you vote for this thing now, which was the prolongation of the draft act and the returning the National Guard in service, what the prolongation of the draft act was, keeping those men in longer than the stipulated period, though it was entirely illegal of what was being done, that I would personally do everything I could in their campaign to support them, and they could figure out how much effect that would be. And they say it would have no effect, they'd just be defeated. And a certain number of them said, well, all right, we'll accept defeat. I think this is essential to the interest of the country. We'll accept defeat. And I took notes of that so that I could go on the platform and use their names and explain exactly what had happened. The war came along, and then there was no necessity for that. People have forgotten entirely the hostility of that time. Life magazine played it up at great length, this Ohio movement over the hill in October. And it was very hard. Certain phases of democracy make it quite a struggle to raise an army. Probably should, I guess. But in the great tragedy the world was in at that time, it made it doubly hard. And it's kind of goes against the grain to find you being criticized, but being cautious in the way you handle this thing. I have no regrets. I think what I did was right. I think even more right to look at it from a longer distance at the present time. I think those who were plunged in would have wrecked the whole enterprise, delayed us until we were forced into it under more serious circumstances. As it was, when we were forced into the war, we had the beginnings of a sizable army. I feel that, of course, there may have been excessive caution at that time for both the White House and the military. What we did was in accord with the White House. I did everything I could to stir the President's appreciation to the vastly critical military situation we had, which we had to cure. It was not a question of imagination. I had too much imagination around me. Members of the staff were terribly concerned, and they spent their time trying to force me and take an open action contrary to the administration, which I declined to do. And in the end, that paid, because all through, I had the backing of the administration in all of these things and the backing of the conservative Congress. There's another factor that comes in all of this. I was opposed to the too rapid reception of the men under the draft because we couldn't handle it. We did not have the instructors. And if we didn't do that part well, we'd submit ourselves to terrific criticism and with the possibility of losing control of the whole business because of the criticism of the way we were doing it. Until the reservists became of age, you might say, until they'd seasoned, so that we could use them in the role of instructors for these very severe training camps they had. And that was at least a year. We have to move with a very careful appreciation of our limitations in instructors. It is I was under pressure because I wouldn't do like Australia did. I was under pressure because we wouldn't smear this up in order to keep it going. I was told that the issue, the situation was grave, and I should slur over this and slur over that. Well, we heard that always. We heard that always. And I feel we were right when we did. I went beyond the staff in the size of the training camps, and they had a terrible time getting appropriate instruction. And I have to inspect these camps time after time to make certain that by a superhuman effort, they were curious. But it was all very difficult. And we were determined to have well-qualified officers, which you couldn't get on short notice. Well-meaning reserve officers, and notably Clark in those fellows, who did a superb job in 1917. Exercised great pressure, and they had the complete sympathy and support of the Secretary of War, because he was of their tribe. He'd gone to a patchwork camp and all that sort of thing. But I just put on the barrel here. We have to do this thing right, or I wasn't going to be aboard. Okay, almost the same.